Separation from God and from each other is the cause of all your dysfunction and suffering. Still, separation continues to masquerade as strength, and your politics, your economics, and even your religions have perpetuated the lie. This lie is the genesis of all wars and all the class struggles that lead to war, of all animosity between races and genders, and all the power struggles that lead to animosity, of all personal trials and tribulations, and all the internal struggles that lead to tribulations. Still you cling to the lie tenaciously, no matter where you've seen it lead you, even as it has led you to your own destruction. Now I tell you this, know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. There is no separation.
Not from each other, not from God, and not from anything that is. This truth I will repeat over and over. This observation I will make again and again. Act as if you were separate from nothing and no one, and you will heal your world tomorrow. This is the greatest secret of all time. It is the answer for which man has searched for millennia. It is the solution for which he has worked, the revelation for which he has prayed. Act as if you were separate from nothing, and you heal the world. Understand that it is about power with, not power over.
So getting back, first it was females who had power over males, and now it's the other way around. And males invented the devil in order to wrest this power away from the female tribal or clan leaders?
Yes. They used fear because fear was the only tool they had.
Again, not much has changed. Men do that to this day. Sometimes even before appeals to reason are tried, men use fear, particularly if they are the bigger man, the stronger man, or the bigger or stronger nation. Sometimes it seems actually ingrained in men. I mean, it seems cellular. Might is right. Strength is power.
Yes. This has been the way since the overturn of the matriarchy.
How did it get that way?
That's what this short history is all about.
Well, then go on, please.
What men had to do to gain control during the matriarchal period was not to convince women that men ought to be given more power over their lives, but to convince other men. Life was, after all, going smoothly, and there were worse ways men could have to get through the day than simply doing some physical work to make themselves valued and then have sex. So it was not easy for men who were powerless to convince other powerless men to seek power until they discovered fear. Fear was the one thing women hadn't counted on. It began, this fear, with seeds of doubt sown by the most disgruntled among the males. These were usually the least desirable of the men, the unmuscled, the unadorned, and hence those to whom women paid the least attention.
And you know, I'll bet that because this was so, their complaints were discounted as the ravings of rage born of sexual frustration.
That is correct. Still, the disgruntled men had to use the only tool they had, so they sought to grow fear from the seeds of doubt. What if the women were wrong? What if their way of running the world wasn't the best? What if it was, in fact, leading the whole society, all of the race, into sure and certain annihilation? This is something many men could not imagine. After all, didn't women have a direct line to the goddess? Were they not, in fact, exact physical replicas of the goddess? Was not the goddess good? The teaching was so powerful, so pervasive, that men had no choice but to invent a devil, a Satan, to counteract the unlimited goodness of the great mother imagined and worshipped by the people of the matriarchy.
How did they manage to convince anyone that there was such a thing as an evil one?
The one thing all of their society understood was the theory of the rotten apple. Even the women saw and knew from their experience that some children simply turned out bad, no matter what they did. Especially, as everybody knew, the boy children who could just not be controlled. So a myth was created. One day the myth went, the great mother, the goddess of goddesses, brought forth a child who turned out to be not good. No matter what the mother tried, the child would not be good. Finally, he struggled with his mother for her very throne. This was too much, even for a loving, forgiving mother. The boy was banished forever, but continued to show up in clever disguises and clever costumes, sometimes even posing as the great mother herself. This myth laid the basis for men to ask, How do we know the goddess we worship is a goddess at all? It could be the bad child now grown up and wanting to fool us. By this device, men got other men to worry, then to be angry that women weren't taking their worries seriously, then to rebel. The being you now call Satan was thus created. It was not difficult to create a myth about a bad child, and not difficult either to convince even the women of the clan of the possibility of the existence of such a creature. It was also not difficult getting anyone to accept that the bad child was male. Weren't males the inferior gender? This device was used to set up a mythological problem. If the bad child was male, if the evil one was masculine, who would there be to overpower him? Surely not a feminine goddess. Foresaid the men cleverly when it came to matters of wisdom and insight, of clarity and compassion, of planning and thinking, no one doubted feminine superiority. Yet in matters of brute strength was not a male needed. Previously in goddess mythology, males were merely consorts, companions to the females, who acted as servants and fulfilled their robust desire for lustful celebration of their goddess magnificence. But now a male was needed who could do more. A male who could also protect the goddess and defeat the enemy. This transformation did not occur overnight, but across many years. Gradually, very gradually, societies began seeing the male consort as also the male protector in their spiritual mythologies. For now that there was someone to protect the goddess from, such a protector was clearly needed. It was not a major leap from male as protector to male as equal partner, now standing alongside the goddess. The male god was created. And for a while, gods and goddesses ruled mythology together. Then, again, gradually, gods were given larger roles. The need for protection, for strength, began to supplant the need for wisdom and love. A new kind of love was born in these mythologies, a love which protects with brute force. But it was a love which also covets what it protects, which was jealous of its goddesses, which now did not simply serve their feminine lusts, but fought and died for them. Myths began to emerge of gods of enormous power, quarreling over, fighting for goddesses of unspeakable beauty. And so was born the jealous god.
This is fascinating.
Wait, we're coming to the end. But there's just a little more. It wasn't long before the jealousy of the gods extended not only to the goddesses, but to all creations in all realms. We had better love him, these jealous gods demanded, and no other god, or else. Since males were the most powerful species, and gods were the most powerful of the males, there seemed little room for argument with this new mythology. Stories of those who did argue and lost began to emerge. The god of wrath was born. Soon the whole idea of deity was subverted. Instead of being the source of all love, it became a source of all fear. A model of love which was largely feminine. The endlessly tolerant love of a mother for a child, and yes, even of a woman for her not too bright, but after all useful man, was replaced by the jealous, wrathful love of a demanding, intolerant god who would brook no interference, allow no insouciance, ignore no offense. The smile of the amused goddess, experiencing limitless love and gently submitting to the laws of nature, was replaced by the stern countenance of the not-so-amused god, proclaiming power over the laws of nature and forevermore limiting love. This is the god you worship today. And that's how you got where you are now.
Amazing. Interesting and amazing. But what is the point of telling me all of this?
It's important for you to know that you've made it all up. The idea that might is right or that power is strength was born in your male-created theological myths. The god of wrath and jealousy and anger was an imagining. It's something you imagined for so long it became real. Some of you still consider it real today, yet it had nothing to do with ultimate reality or what's really going on here.
And what is that?
What's going on is that your soul yearns for the highest experience of itself it can imagine. It came here for that purpose, to realize itself, that is, make itself real, in its experience. Then it discovered pleasures of the flesh, not just sex, but all manner of pleasures. And as it indulged in these pleasures, it gradually forgot the pleasures of the spirit. These too are pleasures, greater pleasures than the body could ever give you. But the soul forgot it.
Okay, now we're getting away from all the history and back into something you've touched on before in this dialogue. Could you go over this again?
Well, we're not actually getting away from the history. We're tying everything in together. You see, it's really quite simple. The purpose of your soul, its reason for coming to the body,
is to be and express who you really are. The soul yearns to do this, yearns to know itself and its own experience. This yearning to know is life seeking to be. This is God choosing to express. The God of your histories is not the God who really is. That is the point. Your soul is the tool through which I express and experience myself.
Doesn't that pretty much limit your experience?
It does, unless it doesn't. That's up to you. You get to be the expression and the experience of me at whatever level you choose. There have been those who have chosen very grand expressions. There have been none higher than Jesus the Christ, though there have been others who have been equally as high.
Christ is not the highest example. He is not God made man.
Christ is the highest example. He is simply not the only example to reach that highest state. Christ is God made man. He is simply not the only man made of God. Every man is God made man. You are me, expressing in your present form. Yet don't worry about limiting me, about how limited that makes me, for I am not limited and never have been. Do you think you are the only form that I have chosen? Do you think you are the only creatures whom I've imbued with the essence of me? I tell you, I am in every flower, every rainbow, every star in the heavens, and everything in and on every planet rotating around every star. I am the whisper of the wind, the warmth of your sun, the incredible individuality and the extraordinary perfection of every snowflake. I am the majesty in the soaring flight of eagles, and the innocence of the doe in the field, the courage of lions, the wisdom of the ancient ones. And I am not limited to the modes of expression seen on your planet alone. You do not know who I am, but only think you do. Yet think not that who I am is limited to you, or that my divine essence, this most Holy Spirit, was given to you and you alone. That would be an arrogant thought and a misinformed one. My beingness is in everything. Everything. The allness is my expression. The wholeness is my nature. There is nothing that I am not, and something I am not cannot be. My purpose in creating you, my blessed creatures, was so that I might have an experience of myself as the creator of my own experience.
Some people don't understand. Help all of us to understand.
The one aspect of God that only a very special creature could create was the aspect of myself as the creator. I am not the god of your mythologies, nor am I the goddess. I am the creator, that which creates. Yet I choose to know myself in my own experience. Just as I know my perfection of design through a snowflake, my awesome beauty through a rose, so too do I know my creative power through you. To you, I have given the ability to consciously create your experience, which is the ability I have. Through you, I can know every aspect of me, the perfection of the snowflake, the awesome beauty of the rose, the courage of lions, the majesty of eagles, all resides in you. In you I have placed all of these things, and one thing more, the consciousness to be aware of it. Thus have you become self-conscious, and thus have you been given the greatest gift, for you have been aware of yourself being yourself, which is exactly what I am. I am myself, aware of myself, being myself. This is what is meant by this statement, I am that I am. You are that part of me which is the awareness experienced. And what you are experiencing and what I am experiencing through you is me, creating me. I am in the continual act of creating myself.
Does that mean that God is not a constant? Does that mean that you do not know what you're going to be in the next moment?
How can I know? You haven't decided yet.
Let me get this straight. I am deciding all of this?
Yes. You are me, choosing to be me. You are me, choosing to be what I am and choosing what I am going to be. All of you, collectively, are creating that. You are doing it on an individual basis as each of you decides who you are and experiences that, and you are doing it collectively as the co-creative collective being that you are. I am the collective experience of the lot of you.
And you really don't know who you're going to be in the next moment?
I was being lighthearted a moment ago. Of course I know. I already know all of your decisions, so I know who I am, who I have always been, and who I will always be.
How can you know what I'm going to choose to be, do, and have in the next moment, much less what the whole human race is going to choose?
Simple. You've already done the choosing. Everything you're ever going to be, do, or have, you've already done. You're doing it right now. Do you see? There's no such thing as time.
Yeah, well, this too we've discussed before.
It's worth reviewing here.
Yes, tell me again how this works.
Past, present, and future are concepts you have constructed, realities you have invented. In order to create a context within which to frame your present experience. Otherwise, all of our experiences would be overlapping. They actually are overlapping. That is, happening at the same time. You simply don't know this. You've placed yourself in a perception shell that blocks out the total reality. I've explained this in detail in book 2. It might be good for you to reread that material in order to place what's being said here into context. The point I'm making here is that everything is happening at once. Everything. So yes, I do know what I'm going to be, what I am, and what I was. I know this always. That is, always. So you see, there is no way you can surprise me. Your story, the whole worldly drama, was created so that you could know who you are in your own experience. It's also been designed to help you forget who you are, so that you might remember who you are once again and create it.
Because I can't create who I am if I'm already experiencing who I am. I can't create being 6 feet tall if I am already 6 feet tall. I'd have to be less than 6 feet tall. Or at least think that I am.
Exactly. You understand it perfectly. And since God, to experience itself as the creator, and since everything has already been created, we had no choice other than to find a way to forget all about our creation.
I'm amazed that we found a way. Try to forget that we are all one, and that the one of us which we are is God. Must be like trying to forget that a pink elephant is in the room. How could we be so mesmerized?
Well, you've just touched on the secret reason for all of physical life. It is life in the physical which has so mesmerized you, and rightly so, because it is, after all, an extraordinary adventure. What we used here to help us forget is what some of you would call the pleasure principle. The highest nature of all pleasure is that aspect of pleasure which causes you to create who you really are in your experience right here, right now. And to recreate and recreate and recreate again who you are at the next highest level of magnificence. That is the highest pleasure of God. The lower nature of all pleasure is that part of pleasure which causes you to forget who you really are. Do not condemn the lower nature, for without it, you could not experience the higher.
It's almost as if the pleasures of the flesh at first cause us to forget who we are, then become the very avenue through which we remember.
There you have it. You've just said it. And the use of physical pleasure as an avenue to remembering who you are is achieved by raising up through the body the basic energy of all life. This is the energy which you sometimes call sexual energy, and it is raised up along the inner column of your being until it reaches the area you call the third eye. This is the area just behind the forehead, between and slightly above the eyes. As you raise the energy, you cause it to course all through your body. It's like an inner orgasm.
How is this done? How do you do that?
You think it up. I mean that, just as I said it. You literally think it up, the inner pathway of what you have called your chakras. Once the life energy is raised up repeatedly, one acquires a taste for this experience, just as one acquires a hunger for sex. The experience of the energy being raised is very sublime. It quickly becomes the experience most desired. Yet you never completely lose your hunger for the lowering of the energy, for the basic passions, nor ought you to try. For the higher cannot exist without the lower in your experience, as I have pointed out too many times. Once you get to the higher, you must go back to the lower in order to experience again the pleasure of moving to the higher. This is the sacred rhythm of all life. You do this not only by moving the energy around inside your body. You also do this by moving around the larger energy inside the body of God. You incarnate as lower forms, then evolve into higher states of consciousness. You are simply raising the energy in the body of God. You are that energy. And when you arrive at the highest state, you experience it fully, then you decide what next you choose to experience and where in the realm of relativity you choose to go in order to experience it. You may wish to again experience yourself becoming yourself. It is a grand experience indeed, and so you may start all over again on the cosmic wheel.
Is this the same as the karmic wheel?
No, there is no such thing as a karmic wheel, not the way you have imagined it. Many of you have imagined that you are on not a wheel, but a treadmill, in which you are working off the debts of past actions and trying valiantly not to incur any new ones. This is what some of you have called the karmic wheel. It's not so very different from a few of your Western theologies, for in both paradigms you are seen as an unworthy sinner, seeking to gain the purity to move on to the next spiritual level. The experience which I've described here, on the other hand, I am calling the cosmic wheel, because there is nothing of unworthiness, debt repayment, punishment, or purification. The cosmic wheel simply describes the ultimate reality, or what you might call the cosmology of the universe. It is the cycle of life, or what I sometimes term the process. It is a picture phrase describing the no beginning and no end nature of things, the continually connected path to and from the all of everything on which the soul joyfully journeys throughout eternity. It is the sacred rhythm of all life by which you move the energy of God.
Wow. I've never had that all explained to me so simply. I don't think I've ever understood all of this so clearly.
Well, clarity is what you brought yourself here to experience. That was the purpose of this dialogue. So I'm glad you're achieving that.
In truth, there is no lower or higher place on the cosmic wheel. How can there be? It's a wheel, not a ladder.
Oh, that's excellent. That is an excellent imagery and an excellent understanding. Therefore, condemn not that which you call lower, basic animal instincts of man, yet bless them, honoring them as the path through which and by which you find your way back home.
This is going to relieve a lot of people of a lot of guilt around sex.
It's why I've said play, play, play with sex and with all of life. Mix what you call the sacred with the sacrilegious, for until you see your altars as the ultimate place for love and your bedrooms as the ultimate place for worship, you see nothing at all. You think sex is separate from God? I tell you this, I am in your bedroom every night. So go ahead, mix what you call the profane and the profound, so that you can see that there is no difference, and experience all as one. Then when you continue to evolve, you will not see yourself as letting go of sex, but simply enjoying it at a higher level. For all of life is S-E-X, synergistic energy exchange. And if you understand this about sex, you will understand this about everything in life, even the end of life, what you call death. At the moment of your death, you will not see yourself as letting go of life, but simply enjoying it at a higher level. When at last you see that there is no separation in God's world, that is, nothing which is not God, then at last will you let go of this invention of man which you have called Satan. If Satan exists, he exists as every thought you ever had of separation from me. You cannot be separate from me, for I am all that is. Men invented the devil to scare people into doing what they wanted, under the threat of separation from God if they did not. Condemnation being hurled into the everlasting fires of hell was the ultimate scare tactic. Yet now you need be afraid no more, for nothing can or ever will separate you from me. You and I are one. We cannot be anything else if I am what I am, all that is. Why then would I condemn myself? And how would I do it? How could I separate myself from myself when myself is all there is and there is nothing else? My purpose is to evolve, not to condemn, to grow, not to die, to experience, not to fail to experience. My purpose is to be, not to cease to be. I have no way to separate myself from you or anything else. Hell is simply not knowing this. Salvation is knowing and understanding it completely. You are now saved. You needn't worry about what's going to happen to you after death anymore.
Can we talk about this death business for a minute? You said this third book was going to be about higher truths, about universal truths. Well, through all the conversations we've had, we haven't talked that much about death and what happens after that. Let's do that now. Let's get to that.
Fine. What do you want to know?
Well, what happens when you die?
What do you choose to have happen?
You mean that what happens is whatever we choose to have happen?
Do you think that just because you've died, you stop creating?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking you.
Fair enough. You do know, incidentally, but I see you've forgotten, which is great. Everything's gone according to plan. When you die, you do not stop creating. Is that definitive enough for you?
Yes.
Good. Now, the reason you do not stop creating when you die is that you don't ever die. You cannot. For you are life itself, and life cannot not be life. Therefore, you cannot die. So at the moment of your death, what happens is you go on living. This is why so many people who have died do not believe it. Because they do not have the experience of being dead. On the contrary, they feel, because they are, very much alive. So there's confusion. The self may see the body lying there, all crumpled up, not moving, yet the self is suddenly moving all over the place. It has the experience often of literally flying all over the room, then of being everywhere in the space, all at once. And when it desires a particular point of view, it suddenly finds itself experiencing that. If the soul, the name we will now give to the self, wonders, gee, why is my body not moving? It will find itself right there, hovering right over the body, watching the stillness curiously. Someone enters the room and the soul thinks, who is that? immediately the soul is in front of or next to that person. Thus, in a very short time, the soul learns that it can go anywhere with the speed of its thought. A feeling of incredible freedom and lightness overtakes the soul, and it usually takes a little while for the entity to get used to all this bouncing around with every thought. If the person had children, and should think of those children, immediately the soul is in the presence of those children wherever they are. Thus the soul learns that not only can it be wherever it wants with the speed of its thought, it can be in two places at once, or three places, or five. It can exist, observe, and conduct activities in these places simultaneously, without difficulty or confusion. Then it can rejoin itself, returning to one place again, simply by refocusing. The soul remembers in the next life what it would have been well to remember in this life, that all effect is created by thought, and that manifestation is a result of intention.
What I focus on as my intention becomes my reality.
Exactly. The only difference is the speed with which you experience the result. In the physical life, there might be a lapse between thought and experience. In the spirit's realm, there is no lapse. Results are instantaneous. Newly departed souls, therefore, learn to monitor their thoughts very carefully, because whatever they think of, they experience. I use the word learn here very loosely, more as a figure of speech than an actual description. The term remember would be more accurate. If physicalized souls learn to control their thoughts as quickly and as efficiently as spiritualized souls, their whole lives would change. In the creation of individual reality, thought control, or what some might call prayer, is everything.
Prayer?
Thought control is the highest form of prayer. Therefore, think only on good things and righteous. Dwell not in negativity and darkness. And even in moments when things look bleak, especially in those moments, see only perfection, express only gratefulness, and then imagine only what manifestation of perfection you choose next. In this formula is found tranquility. In this process is found peace. In this awareness is found joy.
That's extraordinary. That's an extraordinary piece of information. Thanks for bringing that through me.
Thanks for letting it come through. Sometimes you are cleaner than at other times. Some moments you are more open, like a strainer which has just been rinsed. It is more open. There are more holes open.
Good way of putting it.
I do my best. To recap then, souls released from the body quickly remember to monitor and control their thoughts very carefully, for whatever they think of, that is what they create and experience. I say again, it is the same for souls still residing with the body, except the results are usually not as immediate. And it is the time lapse between thought and creation, which can be days, weeks, months, or even years, which creates the illusion that things are happening to you, not because of you. This is an illusion, causing you to forget that you are at cause in the matter. As I have described now several times, this forgetting is built into the system. It is part of the process, for you cannot create who you are until you forget. So the illusion causing forgetfulness is an effect created on purpose. When you leave the body, it will therefore be a big surprise to see the instant, obvious connection between your thoughts and your creations. It will be a shocking surprise at first, and then a very pleasant one, as you begin to remember that you were at cause in the creation of your experience, not at the effect of it.
Why is there such a delay between thought and creation before we die, and no delay at all after we die?
Because you are working within the illusion of time.
Mm.
There's no delay between thought and creation away from the body, because you are also away from the parameter of time.
In other words, as you have said so often, time does not exist.
Not as you understand it. The phenomenon of time is really a function of perspective.
Why does it exist while we are with the body?
You have caused it to by moving into, by assuming your present perspective. You use this perspective as a tool with which you can explore and examine your experiences much more fully by separating them into individual pieces rather than a single occurrence. Life is a single occurrence, an event of the cosmos that is happening right now. All of it is happening everywhere. There is no time but now. There is no place but here. Here and now is all there is. Yet you chose to experience the magnificence of here and now in its every detail and to experience your divine self as the here and now creator of that reality. There are only two ways, two fields of experience in which you could do that. Time and space. So magnificent was this thought that you literally exploded with delight. In that explosion of delight was created space between the parts of you and the time it took to move from one part of yourself to another. In this way, you literally tore yourself apart to look at the pieces of you. You might say that you were so happy you fell to pieces. You've been picking up the pieces ever since.
That's all my life is. I'm just putting together the pieces, trying to see if they make any sense.
And it is through the device called time that you have managed to separate the pieces, to divide the indivisible, thus to see it and experience it more fully as you are creating it. Even as you look at a solid object through a microscope, seeing that it is not solid at all, but actually a conglomeration of a million different effects, different things all happening at once, and thus creating the larger effect. So, too, do you use time as the microscope of your soul. Consider the parable of the rock. Once there was a rock filled with countless atoms, protons, neutrons, and subatomic particles of matter. These particles were racing around continually in a pattern, each particle going from here to there and taking time to do so. Yet going so fast that the rock itself seemed to move not at all. It just was. There it lay, drinking in the sun, soaking up the rain, and moving not at all. "What is this inside of me that is moving?" the rock asked. "It is you," said a voice from afar. "Me?" replied the rock. "Why, that is impossible. I'm not moving at all. Anyone can see that." "Yes, from a distance," the voice agreed. "From way over here, you do look as if you are solid, still, not moving. But when I come closer, when I look very closely at what is actually happening, I see that everything that comprises what you are is moving. It is moving at incredible speed through time and space in a particular pattern which creates you as the thing called rock. And so you are like magic. You are moving and not moving at the same time." "But," asked the rock, "which then is the illusion? The oneness, the stillness of the rock, or the separateness and the movement of its parts?" To which the voice replied, "Which then is the illusion? The oneness, the stillness of God, or the separateness and movement of its parts? And I tell you this, upon this rock I will build my church, for this is the rock of ages. This is the eternal truth that leaves no stone unturned. I've explained it all for you here in this little story. This is the cosmology. Life is a series of minute, incredibly rapid movements. These movements do not affect at all the immobility and the beingness of everything that is. Yet, just as with the atoms of the rock, it is the movement which is creating the stillness right before your eyes. From this distance, there is no separateness. There cannot be. For all that is all there is, and there is nothing else. I am the unmoved mover. From the limited perspective with which you view all that is, you see yourself as separate and apart, not one unmovable being, but many, many beings constantly in motion. Both observations are accurate. Both realities are real.
And when I don't die at all, but simply shift into awareness of the macrocosm, where there is no time or space now and then, before and after.
Precisely. You've got it.
Let me see if I can say it back to you. Let me see if I can describe it.
Go ahead.
Well, from a macro perspective, there is no separateness, and from way back there, all the particles of everything merely look like the whole. As you look at the rock at your feet, you see the rock, right then and there, as whole, complete, and perfect. Yet even in the fraction of a moment that you hold that rock in your awareness, there's a lot going on within that rock. There's incredible movement at incredible speed of the particles of that rock. And what are those particles doing? They're making the rock what it is. As you look at this rock, you do not see this process. Even if you're conceptually aware of it, to you it's all happening now. The rock isn't becoming a rock. It is a rock right here, right now. Yet if you were the consciousness of one of the submolecular particles inside that rock, you would experience yourself moving at insane speed, first here, then there. And if some voice outside the rock said to you, it's all happening at once, you would call it a liar or a charlatan. Still, from the perspective of a distance from the rock, the idea that any part of the rock is separate from any other part, and further is moving around at insane speed, would appear to be the lie. From that distance could be seen what could not be seen up close, that all is one, and that all the movement hasn't moved anything.
You have it. You have a grasp of it. What you are saying, and you are correct, is that life is all a matter of perspective. If you continue to see this truth, you will begin to understand the macro reality of God, and you will have unlocked a secret of the whole universe. All of it is the same thing.
The universe is a molecule in the body of God.
That's actually not so very far off.
And it is to the macro reality that we return in consciousness when we do the thing called die?
Yes. Yet even the macro reality to which you return is but a micro reality of an even larger macro reality, which is a smaller part of a larger reality still, and so on and on and on, forever and ever and even forevermore, world without end. We are God, the it that is, constantly in the act of creating ourselves, constantly in the act of being what we are now, until we aren't that anymore, but become something else. Even the rock will not be a rock forever, but only what seems like forever. Before it was a rock, it was something else. It fossilized into that rock through a process taking hundreds of thousands of years. It was once something else and will be something else again. The same is true of you. You are not always the you that you are now. You are something else. And today, as you stand there in your utter magnificence, you truly are something else again.
Whoa, that's amazing. I mean, that's absolutely amazing. I've never heard anything like that. You've taken the whole cosmology of life and put it in terms I can hold in my mind. That's amazing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm doing my best.
You're doing a damn good job.
That's probably not the phrase you should have chosen there.
Whoops.
Just kidding. Lightening things up here. All having right. A little fun. I cannot actually be offended. Yet your fellow human beings often allow themselves to be offended on my behalf.
So I've noticed. But getting back, I think I've just caught hold of something.
What's that?
This whole explanation rolled out when I asked a single question. How come time exists when we're in the body but not when the soul is released? And what you seem to be saying is that time is really perspective, that it neither exists nor ceases to exist, but that as the soul alters its perspective, we experience ultimate reality in different ways.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You've got it.
And you are making the larger point that in the macrocosm, the soul is aware of the direct relationship between thought and creation, between one's ideas and one's experience.
Yes. At the macro level, it's like seeing the rock and seeing the movement within the rock. There is no time between the movement of the atoms and the appearance of the rock it creates. The rock is, even as the movements occur. Indeed, because the movements occur. This cause and effect is instant. The movement is occurring and the rock is being all at the same time. This is what the soul realizes at the moment of what you call death. It is simply a change in perspective. You see more, so you understand more. After death, you are no longer limited in your understanding. You see the rock, and you see into the rock. You will look at what now seem to be the most complex aspects of life and say, of course, it will all be very clear to you. Then there will be new mysteries for you to ponder. As you move around the cosmic wheel, there will be larger and larger realities, bigger and bigger truths. Yet if you can remember this truth, your perspective creates your thoughts, and your thoughts create everything. And if you can remember it before you leave the body, not after, your whole life will change.
Ah, and the way to control your thoughts is to change your perspective.
Precisely. Assume a different perspective and you will have a different thought about everything. In this way, you will have learned to control your thought. And in the creation of your experience, controlled thought is everything. Some people call this constant prayer.
You've said this before, but I don't think I've ever thought of prayer in this way.
Why not see what happens if you do so? If you imagined that the controlling and directing of your thoughts is the highest form of prayer, you would think only on good things and righteous. You would dwell not in negativity and darkness, though you may be immersed in it. And in moments when things look bleak, perhaps especially in those moments, you would see only perfection.
You have come back to that over and over again.
I am giving you tools. With these tools, you can change your life. I am repeating the most important of them, over and over again.
I am repeating them, for repetition will produce recognition, knowing again, when you need it most. Everything that occurs, everything that has occurred, is occurring, ever will occur, is the outward physical manifestation of your innermost thoughts, choices, ideas, and determinations regarding who you are and who you choose to be. Condemn not, therefore, those aspects of life with which you disagree. Seek instead to change them and the conditions that made them possible. Behold the darkness, yet curse it not. Rather be a light unto the darkness, and so transform it. Let your light so shine before men that those who stand in the darkness will be illumined by the light of your being, and all of you will see at last who you really are. Be a bringer of the light, for your light can do more than illuminate your own path. Your light can be the light which truly lights the world. Shine on then, O Illuminati. Shine on, that the moment of your greatest darkness may yet become your grandest gift. And even as you are gifted, so too will you gift others, giving to them the unspeakable treasure, themselves. Let this be your task. Let this be your greatest joy, to give people back to themselves, even in their darkest hour, especially in that hour. The world waits for you. Heal it. Now. In the place where you are, there is much you can do. For my sheep are lost and must now be found. Be ye therefore as good shepherds and lead them back to me.
Thank you. Thank you for that call and for that challenge. Thank you for that placement of the goal before me. Thank you for always keeping me heading in the direction you know I really want to take. That is why I come to you. That is why I have loved and blessed this dialogue, for it is in conversation with you that I find the divine within me and begin to see it within all others.
My dearly beloved, the heavens rejoice when you say that. That is the very reason I have come to you. And will come to everyone who calls to me, even as I come now to those others who are hearing these words. For this conversation was never intended to be with you alone. It was intended for millions around the world, and it has been placed in each person's hands just exactly when they have needed it, sometimes in the most miraculous ways. It has brought them to the wisdom they themselves have called forth. perfectly suited for this moment in their lives. This is the wonder of what has been happening here, that each of you is producing this result by yourself. It looks as if someone else gave you this material, brought you to this conversation, opened you to this dialogue, yet you brought yourself here. So let us now explore together the remaining questions which you have held in your heart.
May we, please, then speak more of life after death? You were explaining what happens to the soul after death, and I so want to know as much about that as I can.
We will speak of it then, until your yearning has been satisfied. I said earlier that what happens is whatever you want to happen. I meant that. You create your own reality, not only when you are with the body, but when you are away from it. At first, you may not realize this, and so you may not be consciously creating your reality. Your experience will then be created by one of two other energies, your uncontrolled thoughts or the collective consciousness. To the degree that your uncontrolled thoughts are stronger than the collective consciousness, to that degree you will experience them as reality. To the degree that the collective consciousness is accepted, absorbed, and internalized, to that degree you will experience it as your reality. This is no different from how you create what you call reality in your present life. Always in life, you have before you three choices. One, you may allow your uncontrolled thoughts to create the moment. Two, you may allow your creative consciousness to create the moment. Three, you may allow the collective consciousness to create the moment. Here's an irony. In your present life, you find it difficult to create consciously from your individual awareness, and, indeed, often assume your individual understandings to be wrong, given all that you are seeing around you, and so you surrender to the collective consciousness, whether it serves you to do so or not. In the first moments of what you call the afterlife, on the other hand, you may find it difficult to surrender to the collective consciousness, given all that you are seeing around you, which may be unbelievable to you. And so you will be tempted to hold to your own individual understandings, whether they serve you or not. I would tell you this. It is when you are surrounded by lower consciousness that you will benefit more from remaining with your individual understandings. And when you are surrounded by higher consciousness, that you receive greater benefit from surrender. It may therefore be wise to seek beings of high consciousness. I cannot overemphasize the importance of the company you keep. In what you call the afterlife, there is nothing to worry about on this score, for you will instantly and automatically be surrounded by beings of high consciousness and by high consciousness itself. Still, you may not know that you are being so lovingly enveloped. You may not immediately understand. It may therefore seem to you as if you are having things happen to you, that you are at the whim of whatever fortunes are working at the moment. In truth, you experience the consciousness in which you die. Some of you have expectations without even knowing it. All your life you've had thoughts about what occurs after death, and when you die, those thoughts are made manifest. And you suddenly realize, make real, what you've been thinking about. And it is your strongest thoughts, the ones you've held most fervently, that, as always in life, will prevail.
Then a person could go to hell. If people believed all during life that hell is a place which most certainly existed, and that God will judge the quick and the dead, that he will separate the wheat from the chaff and the goats from the sheep, and that they are surely going to hell, given all they have done to offend God, then they would go to hell. They would burn in the everlasting fires of damnation. How could they escape it? You said repeatedly throughout this dialogue that hell does not exist, yet you also say that we create our own reality and have the power to create any reality at all out of our thought about it. So hell, fire, and damnation could and does exist for those who believe in it.
Nothing exists in ultimate reality save that which is. You are correct in pointing out that you may create any sub-reality you choose, including the experience of hell as you describe it. I've never said at any point in this entire dialogue that you could not experience hell. I said that hell does not exist. Most of what you experience does not exist, yet you experience it nonetheless.
This is unbelievable. A friend of mine named Barnett Bain just produced a movie about this. I mean, about this exactly. It's August 7th, 1998, as I speak these words, and I'm inserting this in the dialogue in between lines of a discussion of 2 years ago, and I have never done this before, but just before sending this to the publisher, I was rereading the manuscript one last time, and I realized, hold it! Hold it! Robin Williams has just made a movie about exactly what we're talking about here. It's called What Dreams May Come, and it's a startling depiction on film of what you've just said.
I am familiar with it.
You are? God goes to the movies?
God makes movies.
Whoa.
Yes. You never saw Oh God?
Well, sure, but I never...
what do you think, God only writes books?
So is the Robin Williams movie literally true? I mean, is that how it is?
No. No movie or book or other human explanation of the divine is literally true.
Not even the Bible? The Bible is not literally true?
No. And I think you know that.
Well, what about this book? Surely this book is literally true.
No, I hate to tell you this, but you're bringing this through your personal filter.
Mm.
Now, I will agree that the mesh on your filter is thinner, finer. You've become a very good filter. But you are a filter nonetheless.
Yeah, I know that. I just wanted it stated again here, because some people take books like this and movies like What Dreams May Come as, well, as literal truths. And I want to stop them from doing that.
The writers and producers of that film brought some enormous truth through an imperfect filter. The point they sought to make is that you will experience after death exactly what you expect and choose to experience. They made that point very effectively. Now, shall we get back to where we were?
Yes. I'd like to know just what I wanted to know when I was watching that movie. If there is no hell, yet I am experiencing hell, what the hell is the difference?
There wouldn't be any as long as you remain in your created reality. Yet you will not create such a reality forever. Some of you won't experience it for more than what you would call a nanosecond. And therefore you will not experience, even in the private domains of your own imagination, a place of sadness or suffering.
Well, what would stop me from creating such a place for all eternity if I believed all my life that there was such a place and that something I had done had caused me to deserve such a place?
Your knowledge and understanding. Just as in this life your next moment is created out of the new understandings you've gained from your last moment, so too in what you call the afterlife will you create a new moment from what you've come to know and understand in the old. And one thing you will come to know and understand very quickly is that you are at choice always about what you wish to experience. That is because in the afterlife, results are instantaneous, and you will not be able to miss the connection between your thoughts about a thing and the experience those thoughts create. You will understand yourself to be creating your own reality.
Well, this would explain why some people's experience is happy and some people's experience is frightening. Why some people's experience is profound while other people's experience is virtually non-existent. And why so many different stories exist about what happens in the moments after death. Some people come back from near-death experiences filled with peace and love and with no fear ever again of death, while others return very frightened, certain that they've just encountered dark and evil forces.
The soul responds to, recreates the mind's most powerful suggestion, producing that in its experience. Some souls remain in that experience for a time, making it very real, even as they remained in their experiences while with the body, though they were equally as unreal and impermanent. Other souls quickly adjust, see the experience for what it is, begin to think new thoughts, and move immediately to new experiences.
Do you mean that there is no one particular way that things are in the afterlife? Are there no eternal truths that exist outside of my own mind? Do we continue to go on creating myths and legends and make-believe experiences right past our death and into the next reality? When do we get released from the bondage? When do we come to know the truth?
When you choose to. That was the point of the Robin Williams movie. That is the point being made here. Those whose only desire is to know the eternal truth of all that is, to understand the great mysteries, to experience the grandest reality, do so. Yes, there is a one great truth. There is a final reality. But you will always get what you choose, regardless of that reality, precisely because the reality is that you are a divine creature, divinely creating your reality even as you are experiencing it. Yet should you choose to stop creating your own individual reality and begin to understand and experience the larger unified reality, you will have an immediate opportunity to do that. Those who die in a state of such choosing, of such desiring, of such willingness and such knowing, move into the experience of the oneness at once. Others move into the experience only if, as, and when they so desire. It is precisely the same when the soul is with the body. It is all a matter of desire, of your choosing, of your creating, and ultimately, of your creating the uncreatable, that is, of your experiencing that which has already been created.
This is the created creator, the unmoved mover. It is the Alpha and the Omega, the before and the after, the now, then, always aspect of everything which you call God. I will not forsake you, yet I will not force myself upon you. I've never done so, and I never will. You may return to me whenever you wish, now, while you are with the body, or after you have left it. You may return to the One and experience the loss of your individual self whenever it pleases you. You may also recreate the experience of your individual self whenever you choose. You may experience any aspect of the all that is that you wish, in its tiniest proportion or its grandest. You may experience the microcosm or the macrocosm.
I may experience the particle or the rock.
Yes, good, you are getting this. When you reside with a human body, you are experiencing a smaller portion than the whole. That is, a portion of the microcosm, although by no means the smallest portion thereof. When you reside away from the body in what some would call the spirit world, you have enlarged by quantum leaps your perspective. You will suddenly seem to know everything, be able to be everything. You will have a macrocosmic view of things, allowing you to understand that which you do not now understand. One of the things you will then understand is that there is a larger macrocosm still. That is, you will suddenly become clear that all that is even greater than the reality you are then experiencing. This will fill you at once with awe and anticipation, wonder and excitement, joy and exhilaration. For you will then know and understand what I know and understand, that the game never ends.
Will I ever get to a place of true wisdom?
In the time after your death, you may choose to have every question you ever had answered and open yourself to new questions you never dreamed existed. You may choose to experience oneness with all that is, and you will have a chance to decide what you wish to be, do, and have next. You choose to return to your most recent body. You choose to experience life again in human form, but of another kind. Do you choose to remain where you are in the spirit world at the level you are then experiencing? Do you choose to go on, go further in your knowing and experiencing? Do you choose to lose your identity altogether and now become part of the oneness? What do you choose? What do you choose? What do you choose? Always that is the question I will be asking you. Always that is the inquiry of the universe. For the universe knows nothing except how to grant your fondest wish, your greatest desire. Indeed, it is doing that every moment, every day. The difference between you and me is that you are not consciously aware of this. I am.
Tell me, will my relatives, my loved ones, meet me after I die and help me understand what's going on, as some people say they will? Will I be reunited with those who have gone before? Will we be able to spend eternity together?
What do you choose? You choose for these things to happen? Then they will.
Okay, I'm confused. Are you saying that all of us have free will and that this free will extends even past our death?
Yes, that is what I am saying.
Well, if that's true, then the free will of my loved ones would have to coincide with mine. They must have the same thought and desire that I have when I'm having it, or they wouldn't be there for me when I die. Further, what if I wanted to spend the rest of eternity with them and one or two of them wanted to move on? Maybe one of them wanted to move higher and higher into this experience of reunification with the oneness, as you put it. Then what?
There is no contradiction in the universe. There are things that look like contradictions, but there are none, in fact. Should a situation arise such as the one you described, it's a very good question, by the way, what will happen is that you will both be able to have what you choose.
Both?
Both.
May I ask how?
You may.
Okay, how?
What is your thought about God? You think that I exist in one place only?
No, I think you exist everywhere at once. I believe God is omnipresent.
Well, you are right about that. There is nowhere that I am not. Do you understand this?
I think so.
Good. So what makes you think it's any different with you?
Well, because you're God and I'm a mere mortal.
I see. We're still hung up on this mere mortal thing.
Okay, okay. Suppose I assume for the sake of discussion that I too am God, or at least made up of the same stuff as God. Then are you saying that I too can be everywhere, all the time?
It is merely a matter of what the consciousness chooses to hold in its reality. In what you would call the spirit world, what you can imagine, you can experience. Now, if you want to experience yourself being one soul in one place at one time, you may do that. Yet if you wish to experience your spirit being larger than that, being in more than one place at one time, you may do that as well. Indeed, you may experience your spirit as being anywhere you wish, any time. That is because, in truth, there is only one time and one place, and you are in all of it always. You may thus experience any part or parts of it you wish, whenever you choose.
But what if I want my relatives to be with me, but one of them wants to be a part of the all that is somewhere else? What then?
It is not possible for you and your relatives not to want the same thing. You and I and your relatives and I, all of us, are one and the same. The very act of your desiring something is the act of me desiring something, since you are simply me, acting out the experience called desire. Therefore, what you desire, I desire. Your relatives and I are also one and the same. Therefore, what I am desiring, they are desiring. So it follows then that what you desire, you're... On earth, it is also true that all of you desire the same thing. You desire peace. You desire prosperity. You desire joy. You desire fulfillment. You desire satisfaction and self-expression in your work, love in your life, health in your body. You all desire the same thing. You think this is a coincidence? It is not. It is the way life works. I am explaining that to you right now. Now, the only thing that's different on earth from the way it is in what you call the spirit world is that on earth, while you all desire the same thing, you all have different ideas about how to go about having it. So you're all going in different directions seeking the same thing. It's these differing ideas you have that produce your differing results. These ideas might be called your sponsoring thoughts. I have spoken to you of this before.
Yes, in Book One.
One such thought which many of you share in common is your idea of insufficiency. Many of you believe at the core of your being that there is simply not enough of anything. There's not enough love, not enough money, not enough food, not enough clothing, not enough shelter, not enough time, not enough good ideas to go around, and certainly not enough of you to go around. This sponsoring thought causes you to employ all sorts of strategies and tactics in seeking to acquire what you think there is not enough of. These are approaches you would abandon at once when you clear that there is enough for everybody, of whatever it is that you desire. In what you call heaven, your ideas of not enoughness disappear because you become aware that there is no separation between you and anything you desire. You are aware that there's even more than enough of you. You are aware that you can be in more than one place at any given time, so there is no reason not to want what your brother wants, not to choose what your sister chooses. If they want you in their space at the moment of their death, the very thought of you calls you to them, and you have no reason not to race to them, since your going there takes away nothing from whatever else you may be doing. This state of having no reason to say no is the state in which I reside at all times. You've heard it said before, and it is true. God never says no. I will give you all exactly what you desire always, even as I have done from the beginning of time.
Are you really always giving everyone exactly what they desire at any given time?
Yes, my beloved, I am. Your life is a reflection of what you desire, and what you believe you may have of what you desire. I cannot give you what you do not believe you may have, no matter how much you desire it, because I will not violate your own thought about it. I cannot. That is the law. Believing that you cannot have something is the same thing as not desiring to have it, for it produces the same result.
But on earth, we cannot have whatever we desire. We can't be in two places at once, for instance. And there are many other things we may desire but can't have, because on earth, we're all so limited.
I know that you see it that way, and so that is the way it is for you. For one thing that remains eternally true is that you'll always be given the experience you believe you will be given. Thus, if you say that you cannot be in two places at once, then you cannot be. But if you say that you can be anywhere you wish with the speed of your thought, and can even make yourself manifest in physical form in more than one place at any given time, then you may do that.
Now, you see, that's where this dialogue leaves me. I want to believe that this information is coming straight from God, but when you say things like that, I get all crazy inside because I just can't believe that. I mean, I just don't think that what you've said there is true. Nothing in the human experience has demonstrated that.
On the contrary, saints and sages of all religions have been said to have done both of these things. Does it take a very high level of belief, an extraordinary level of belief, the level of belief attained by one being in 1,000 years? Yes. Does that mean it is impossible? No.
How can I create that belief? How can I get to that level of belief?
You cannot get there. You can only be there. And I'm not trying to play with words. I mean that. This kind of belief, what I would call complete knowing, is not something you try to acquire. In fact, if you are trying to acquire it, you cannot have it. It is something you simply are. You simply are this knowing. You are this being. Such beingness comes out of a state of total awareness. It can come out of only such a state. If you are seeking to become aware, then you cannot be. It's like trying to be 6 feet tall when you are 4 foot nine. You cannot be 6 feet tall. You can only be what you are, 4 foot nine. You will be 6 feet tall when you grow into that. When you are 6 feet tall, you will then be able to do all the things that 6 foot tall people can do. And when you are in a state of total awareness, then you will be able to do all the things that beings in a state of total awareness can do. Do not therefore try to believe that you can do these things. Try instead to move to a state of total awareness. Then belief will no longer be necessary. Complete knowing will work its wonders.
Once, when I was meditating, I had the experience of total oneness, of total awareness. It was wonderful. It was ecstatic. Ever since then, I've been trying to have that experience again. I sit in meditation and try to have that total awareness again, but I've never been able to. This is the reason, right? You're saying to me that as long as I am seeking to have something, I cannot have it, because my very seeking is a statement that I do not now have it. The same wisdom you've been giving me throughout this dialogue.
Yes, yes. Now you understand it. It's becoming more clear to you now. That is why we keep going around in circles here. That is why we keep repeating things, revisiting things. You get it the third, the fourth, maybe the fifth time around.
Well, I'm glad I asked the question, because this could be dangerous stuff, you know, this business about you can be in two places at once, or you can do anything you want to do. This is the kind of stuff that makes people run to jump off the Empire State Building shouting, "I'm God, look at me, I can fly."
You'd better be in a state of total awareness before you do that. If you have to prove yourself to be God by demonstrating it to others, then you do not know yourself to be. And this not knowing will demonstrate itself in your reality. In short, you will fall flat on your face. God seeks to prove itself to no one, for God has no need to do that. God is, and that is what is so. Those who know themselves to be one with God, or have the experience of God within, have no need, nor do they seek to prove that to anyone, least of all, themselves. And so it was that when they taunted him, saying, "If you are the Son of God, come down from that cross," the man called Jesus did nothing. Yet 3 days later, quietly and unobtrusively, when there were no witnesses and no crowds and no one to whom to prove anything, he did something a great deal more astonishing, and the world has been talking about it ever since. And in this miracle is found your salvation, for you have been shown the truth, not only of Jesus, but of who you are, and may thus be saved from the lie about yourself, which you have been told, and which you have